Well, as I said, we are beginning this, continuing in this new series called Revival, and we're talking about the faith of the Church of England and the faith that began Methodism in the early 18th century. And in this time period in England, to recap last week, in this time period we saw tremendous religious turmoil. People were beginning to say that they really didn't want to be a part of the church because the church was spending all of its time arguing and couldn't quite decide amongst themselves what the correct theology was. And they said, I don't want to be a part of the church because it has too many rules. And those who were a part of the church, they really weren't really a part of the church. They attended and they worshiped, but their heart wasn't in it for God, and they weren't connected to God. And into this world, we had an individual who said that, I think that we are supposed to be altogether Christians, and I think that we are supposed to be connected to God, and I think our life in God is supposed to be close and growth, inspiring and impactful. And started a movement that grew like wildfire. And since today we're in another point in the history where the church is saying that we don't want to be a part of this anymore, and those who are in church oftentimes are there because somebody demands that they be there or they feel like it's some sort of social obligation, but they're not quite there to have a heart for worship or to be connected to God. And so we talk about these things to see what that might look like to bring the church back to what it could be. And I want to take time also to encourage you and remind you that what we cover in the sermon is a small tidbit of what we need to talk about and what's important. And so Roger's been leading a 7 o'clock study series here at the church downstairs, and I really want to encourage you to come to that. Those who have been can tell you how much great discussion we had and what we learned and the things that we got to see. Really, truly, I can tell you that it would be wonderful to see you there because we're learning a lot and we're having a lot of great discussion and we learn more from one another. We're the kind of beings that God has created that learn from one another. So it would be wonderful if you could be with us so that we could learn from one another. So as I was saying, we're talking about this, and we're kind of skipping ahead just a little bit. And we talked about the time before Wesley. We talked about what the world looked like in the precursors to revival. Well, here we are in 1706. John Wesley is born in Epworth, and he grows up, as we talked about last week, in Epworth, England, in this small town where his father is the priest of the local parish, and his mother spends a tremendous amount of time teaching him about faith. At about the age of 10, John Wesley goes to the Charterhouse School. Charterhouse School is a very good private school. It's not the kind of school that John Wesley's family can afford. But thanks to his intelligence and some scholarships and a few other opportunities that they were able to scrounge up through the church, they were able to send him to the Charterhouse School. This is one of the most prestigious educational facilities for young people in England. So he attends. Wesley would later write that his time at the Charterhouse School was spent studying and was spent learning to interact with other people, but he said his outward appearance and his outward behaviors weren't inward. He began to realize at a young age that he, at the Charterhouse School, which of course taught religion among other things, that he was doing all the things they said that he was supposed to do. He was praying, he was reading his Bible, he was going to church, but in his heart he didn't feel any connection to God, and in his heart he didn't have any real desire to go away from sin. So he said he focused more on doing less sins than the other guys. So his faith was a combination of being better than everyone else, going to church, and praying. Doesn't that sound like the kind of people that are driving people away from the church these days? That's what John Wesley was growing up. And then when he was about 17 years old, he headed off to Oxford University. He went to one of the most prestigious universities in the world, even today. He went specifically to Christ Church. Now, a university, for those who don't know, is a collection of colleges. The words college and university don't mean the same thing. Every university has colleges, but not every college is part of a university. So a university is a collection of colleges. If you go up to St. Louis University, you're going to find the College of Business, the School of Medicine, the School of Pharmacology, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, Oxford is made up of a number of schools, and Christ Church was among the most prestigious of Oxford's colleges. He had done extremely well in his elementary and essentially high school education, and he was able to go to Oxford University, to one of their most prestigious schools, and he began to pursue his bachelor's degree. While there, he discovered that he had kind of a call towards academia and education. He was a typical undergrad student. According to one of his biographers, he said that his favorite things to do were to go to the coffee house, play pool, play chess, play backgammon, and row his boat on the river. So really, not really all that unusual for a college kid. He wants to go to the coffee house and play games with his friends and go out on the river, right? I'm sure if they had college football, he'd be watching that too. You know, he was a typical college student. Teacher said that he was often distracted, but he was an incredibly great student and very logical. One of his professors wrote that he was the wittiest student he'd ever had. And so John Wesley was doing very, very well at Christ Church. And he did his undergraduate there and continued on. And as he finished his undergrad, he started to feel this calling to academia. He was in love with school. He was in love with the university. He was in love with the idea of learning and reading and becoming closer to God by becoming stronger in knowledge. And so he began to get really involved in Oxford. So he began to pursue ordination. See, at that time, to become a professor, you had to be ordained. Now, you could be a teacher, but again, just like not every university, not every college is part of a university, not every teacher is a professor at a university. There's lots of lecturers and fellows and teachers, but only a handful of professors who are the leading and supervising teachers. They are the ones who have earned that title, professor. At many universities, there's only one professor for each department. The rest are associate professors, and then from there you have adjuncts and lecturers. So, you know, for example, at the university I attend, you know, we have a professor of psychology, one individual. The rest are associate professors of psychology, and then we have adjuncts and lecturers. So John Wesley was seeking to be a professor. That was his goal. And to do that, you had to be ordained. So he began to do two things at once. He began to pursue his master's degree, and he began to pursue ordination as a deacon so that he could become a professor. And he worked hard, and of course, he was a very good student, a very bright individual, and he began reading. And as you might imagine, an academic individual pursuing a graduate degree, he had to do some reading. And in one of those books he wanted to read, that he got to read, was Jeremy Taylor's The Rule and Exercises of Holy Living, which was published about 75 years prior to Wesley reading it. Now, the theme of this work was on 1 Corinthians 10:31, which says, so whether you eat or drink, do whatever you do for the glory of God. What Jeremy Taylor was saying was that everything we do has implications with God. Everything we do is consecrated for God. Every conversation we have should serve to glorify God. Every meal we eat is a blessing from God. Every relationship we form is consecrated by God. And this really challenged Wesley. This challenged him because he had grown up with this attitude that religion is all about being better than the next person, going to church, and praying, right? So it's really challenging when he begins to study his faith and really dive into it, because even though that's what he was going to teach, he was teaching philosophy and religion and those sorts of studies. So he started to really dive into what being a Christian is all about, and he realizes that it's every moment in our life. That this call to be a Christian is a universal call to put everything that we do forward for God, to put our relationships, our children, our everything we do, even our work, to have it consecrated by God. He began to understand holiness. Now, the Webster or Oxford definition of holy is to be consecrated for religious purposes by God. That's the definition. Wesley was starting to understand what to be consecrated for religious purposes by God meant. Began to understand that to be holy meant to be connected to God, and meant that everything you do for God, as opposed to what he had grown up believing, which was just do enough things for God, and the rest you don't have to worry about. In our scripture this morning, we heard again from Paul. We heard this staggeringly simple, short, and profound statement. I think one of the cool things about Christianity and faith is that nothing really new has been said in 2,000 years. But we rehash it with new authors and new ideas and new ways of saying it, and it really clicks with us. But way before Wesley, way before the holiness movement, way before people got together and said that there's a call to be an altogether Christian and to be holy, Paul told his churches that you've got to be holy, that you have a call to do everything you do for God. And in 1 Peter, we read that again. We read this call to be holy, telling us that our call as Christians, that every action and movement in our lives is supposed to be consecrated by God for the purpose of our faith. It's a tough spot to be in for John Wesley. When you begin to realize that the Christian faith is not about checking off a couple of things off your list, that it's about everything that we do. When John Wesley began to realize that being a Christian is not something you are, it's something you do, and it's something you do intentionally. When he begins to realize this, he really begins to challenge himself, and he really begins to struggle with the understanding of his own ordination. It's crazy to think that somebody pursuing ordination could have a sudden call to faith, but that's what was happening. As he was getting closer to that moment, he began to be more intentional about his faith. Jeremy Taylor suggested that everything we do begins with prayer, and Wesley really took that to heart. Prayer became very important for him after that. Have you ever heard of what's called a breath prayer? Adam Hamilton mentions this in his book. You ever heard of a breath prayer? Breath prayer is a prayer you can say in one breath. For example, Lord, give me strength. Or Lord, help me. Or Lord, give me peace. An example of a long breath prayer, but you can still do with one within one breath, would be Psalm 115:1. Not to us, O Lord, but to your name give the glory. It's a simple prayer. John Wesley didn't think that every time anything happened, he had to run up to the chapel and sit in front of the altar and pray for 6 hours. But he absolutely did think that before every decision he made, before every meal he ate, before every conversation he had, before everything he did, he would say a prayer, a short prayer, out loud in his head. And I imagine that it is amazing, because I can tell you it's amazing, what happens when your life becomes centered around prayer, when every decision you make starts to become after prayer. When you do those breath prayers, if that's what works for you, or however it works for you to pray before decisions are made, before conversations happen, it's amazing what happens when we put God in charge. I've seen the bumper sticker, God is my co-pilot. Have you seen that? I think if God is your co-pilot, you better switch seats. Wesley noted that after reading this book, he said, instantly, this is his quote, instantly I resolved to dedicate my life to God, all my thoughts and words and actions. Again, this is a guy who's pursuing ordination, pursuing his master's degree at a religious university, and this is the moment that he says, I decided to give my life to God, right? He grew up understanding God. He attended religious schools. His dad was a priest, but it took him until now to really realize that he had to commit himself to God. It's really incredible that this would happen to him during his graduate studies. You see, for Wesley, the idea of doing everything for the glory of God was what it was all about, and that would become the mark of the early Methodists. The early Methodists would be all about doing everything for the glory of God. John Wesley's education continued, and at the age of 27, he read William Law's book, A Serious Call to the Devout and Holy Life. It convinced Wesley of the absolute impossibility of being half a Christian. That's his quote, the absolute impossibility of being half a Christian. And I love that. He says you can't be a half a Christian, or if you want to use the quote from Christy Dean's book, almost Christian. You can't almost be a Christian. You have to be an altogether Christian. Everything about you has to emanate Christ. Everything about you has to be connected to God. You can't be almost Christian. You can't be half a Christian. So John Wesley is then quoted as calling the call to Christian faith to be a call to be an altogether Christian, meaning a Christian who did everything they could for God. You know, we have a tendency to wear rose-colored glasses. We have a tendency to talk about the good old days, right? It's comical. Every generation has the same complaints about the new generation. The same complaints. They're disrespectful. Their music is terrible. They don't dress well, and they don't work hard. Every generation says that about the next generation. I guarantee you the folks who are complaining about your generation were complained about by the generation before them. It never stops. Now, what it looks like changes. The clothes they don't like changes. The music they don't like changes. And the things you aren't doing they think you should be doing changes. But the idea doesn't change. We wear rose-colored glasses because every generation has the same thoughts. And that happens in our spirituality and in our faith. Not to say that certain things don't get worse and better as time goes on. But for the most part, not much has changed in thousands of years. But we have a tendency with our spiritual life to wear rose-colored glasses too. We have a tendency to look back and say, you know, the Christian faith was really good many years ago, but it isn't anymore. Years ago, people were committed to God, and they were committed to their church, but they aren't anymore. But we're looking at John Wesley in this time period when that just was not the case. Although it's gone up and down, and certainly after this moment, it went up. But there was a tremendous amount of time in which the people of God were falling away from God. The people had an understanding about church. They went to church. They attended worship. They didn't miss. You couldn't. It was kind of the law. They didn't miss worship. They attended all the ordinances. They did everything they were supposed to do, but their heart wasn't in it, and John Wesley began to realize that. They attended church as if they were going to get an attendance prize in heaven. Like the guys who went to church the most got to be in the front of the line or something like that, you know. It wasn't about a connection to God. It was about fulfilling an obligation. And John Wesley realized that that's half a Christian. An altogether Christian worships God because of a desire for God. And altogether Christian worships God in everything they do, not just in church. Pursuing a Christian life devoted to the ministry and the work of God became pivotal to John Wesley. In 1726, he was elected as a fellow of Lincoln College. Now, a fellow, you need to understand, is a very prestigious title. A fellow has teaching duties. They teach classes. They moderate debates. They serve as the governing board of the university. and they preach in the chapel services. A fellow of the college is a very important individual. So he was a fellow of Lincoln College, which again was a college that made up Oxford University. Wesley would be really touched by this and really impacted by this. This was kind of a crowning achievement for Wesley's career. As he went on, he got married, and what you have to understand is in the Church of England, today and then, there were two orders, essentially, of priests. And one was a secular order, and one was a monastic order. The secular order could get married. The other order could not. The other order had to remain celibate. And Oxford University is very religiously connected and dedicated to the Church of England, and they understood fellows to be under that same sort of order as a monastic order. They were connected to God, and it was very important to them that you remain single and devoted to the college because it was a ministry. In our Christian universities today, we've gotten away from that. We don't look at universities as a ministry anymore, but at Oxford in the time, it was certainly a ministry. This was your calling from God to be a fellow. This is your ministry. This is the role that you fill as a person who is fulfilling God's call. And so, and their understanding then, it's changed since then, but their understanding then is that you could not do that and be married at the same time. So John Wesley would get married and would lose his status as a fellow, but from then on for the rest of his life, he would actually refer to himself as a sometime fellow of Lincoln College. He was very, very proud of having made that achievement. That was very important to him. And so we can see that education is tremendously important for John Wesley. In John Wesley's England, this was not a time period when people checked the brains at the door. This wasn't a church that said, you know, if you spend too much time in school or learning, then you won't have enough time for God, or everything you need to know is in the Bible, and learning things beyond that is a waste of time or going to hurt you. And that's kind of an American thing, and it's kind of an American thing in the last 40 years. In John Wesley's England, the church's ministry was the university, was the pursuit of knowledge, to teach and to educate so that people could know everything they could about this amazing world that God's created. And thankfully, that's carried on in Methodism, and that's something that has defined Methodism. So the following summer, after he was ordained a deacon and later a priest, he returned to teaching duties. But then he went on to be an associate pastor, a curate, at his father's church in Epworth as a deacon. He did that for about a year. And nothing pretty exciting happened while he was in Epworth, but he got to spend time with his dad and got to spend time performing ministry as an ordained individual, as an ordained deacon. Even though his calling, as they understand it, was to Oxford, there were still times where he was going to be called to go to other places and to preach and to do those sorts of things. So he spent a year as a curate. The following summer, he went back to Oxford, back to Lincoln College, and began teaching again. He taught Greek and logic and philosophy. And later that winter, John and his brother Charles and two other students began meeting several times each week. They did two things. They studied the classics, and they studied spirituality. Again, merging education and faith. It was not two distinct things. Their understanding was, since you do everything for the glory of God, if you're in college and you're learning, then you learn for the glory of God. So they studied the classics, they did their homework, and they studied their faith. And they began to do this every day. This became a constant and important part of their lives. They would come together for Holy Communion, to receive the Eucharist, and then they would pray together and learn together. That began the Methodist movement, which was a campus ministry. The original Methodist movement was a campus ministry. It was folks on a college campus who said, yeah, we've got a chapel. Yeah, we've got curates here who are responsible for our spiritual well-being. And yes, our professors are all ordained priests, but you know what? We need even more than that. We need a connection to God that's a small group that's independent that says, we're going to give you what you need to become an altogether Christian connected to God. And that's what Wesley did. It was a campus ministry. Early Methodism was not a church. It was not a denomination. It was a ministry within the church to see the connection and growth of people. But it worked so well that it grew so fast it had to become its own church. Wesley's movement looked a lot like the early church. In Acts 2:42, we read, they devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and fellowship, to the breaking of bread, and the prayers. Early Christians gathered to learn from one another, to celebrate communion, and to pray. That's what they did. The church has changed over the years, and it's a good thing, and worship is different in every church, and that's a great thing. I think it's really cool how in different churches you can experience worship in different ways. They'll have different hymns they like to sing, or they'll have different ways, different instruments, especially in different parts of the world. I tell you something really neat is to go see African tribal worship, and we have Methodist churches in Africa, and especially in Mozambique, and the way they blend American Protestant worship with the spiritual worship that they have in that area. And it's really cool to see the way that different parts of the world, different people worship. But in the early church, worship was kind of just beginning to start. And so they had three essential things that they all did. The first was the time for learning. that was a time where they sat around in their house churches. By the way, the early church met for hours at a time. There was no one-hour service with a 15-minute sermon. They would sit around and learn from one another. They didn't have the Bible yet, but they would read scriptures and passages they had. They had a Bible. They had the Hebrew Bible. They had the Old Testament. They would read that, and they would read the letters and things from Paul and others, and they would attempt to know Christ and to know their faith. Or they would hear from the apostles, and they would be lectured as students. Then they would break bread together, and they would pray together. This was an important component of the early church. The early church, when Christ instituted communion, that became an every time thing for the early church, and really for the church all the way up until about the Civil War. Communion was a weekly thing. There was never a concept of communion less than once a week, because that is a component of the early church, that you break bread, and that you pray, and that you learn. And the singing and worshiping are awesome, awesome additions, but the original components were those components of Wesley's group too. They had the Eucharist, they broke bread, they prayed, and they learned. And so Wesley's movement was successful. In fact, they were called, they earned the name Methodism because of the strict and methodical way in which they did their work. Every day you knew where Wesley and his students were. At 5 o'clock in the morning, 5:30 in the morning, you knew where they were. They were together, they were praying. If you were on the campus, you could set your watch to what time they'll be taking communion, what time they'll be praying, what time they'll be learning from one another. They were very methodical in the way they worship God. And a lot of folks teased them about that, but a lot more folks joined up with them. Because what happened was they were used to seeing mundane shuffle through faith where they just do whatever it is they're supposed to do. It was incredible to see genuine faith in their campus that was connected to God and just wanted to have more God. That genuine faith was amazing to them, and they saw that. Again, like the early church, imagine what it would have been like to be a non-Christian in Rome after Nero had chased the Christians and the Jews out. Imagine what it would have been like to be an individual who believed what everyone else in your country believed, that Caesar was God. And now imagine that you walk by and you see a group of 8 or 10 people worshiping a God that's illegal, worshiping a God that you are told doesn't exist, and that if you believe it exists, then you could be executed. Imagine walking by that and seeing that faith. What would that do to your soul? Imagine seeing people who, at risk of death or persecution or imprisonment, imagine seeing people connected to God, worshiping God, being faithful, not missing church for a week, even at risk that they could be killed. Imagine what that would do for your soul. Wouldn't you want that? Wouldn't you at least wonder what that's like to have that kind of faith and commitment? Wouldn't you at least want to know how they can do that? What motivates them to want to be that way? That's why the early Christian church grew like wildfire, because people saw it was genuine, and eventually the governments couldn't control it. It got too big. Because people saw genuine faith. They saw faith that didn't care what the government said. It only cared about God. And that's what happened with Wesley. On the contrary, everybody went to church instead of nobody. But it wasn't genuine. Everybody went to church. But when I walk by after leaving church, I see this group of kids and their teacher who spends all their time praying to God and takes communion more than just the required once a week or the required once at Easter. And see kids who pray to God and sing hymns to God and want to learn about God. I mean, my gosh, the priest preached for an hour back at the chapel of the university. What more do you need? But what enough for them? They had their Bibles open and they were learning. And people saw a genuine faith. They wanted that. They said, I wonder what it's like to feel God like that. I wonder what it's like to desire God like that. Friends, the reality is when revival happens, it's when faith is genuine. When we go out into the world and people look at us and say, gee, I really wish I had a faith like they did. Not because I go to church every Sunday. Nobody's saying, gee, I wish I had the kind of faith that didn't miss church. No. Gee, I wish I knew what it was like to have the kind of faith that constantly desired God. That it seems like every moment in their life is about God. Every time you turn, they're praying. You know people like that, don't you? I know people like that. I know some of you like that. I go to visit you and I see you and your Bibles are open and you're praying and your faith is pivotal and central to your life. And let me tell you, that's a genuine witness. And that'll do 10 times more than any preacher in a revival under a tent. When people see genuine faith, they want genuine faith. When we show something like that, they have something they want. And that was the early Methodist. The early Methodist was nothing more than a group of people who said, I give up. I want to be an altogether Christian. I want what you've got. I want to be an altogether Christian. So the movement grew. 3 students and John Wesley. Then a couple of years, couple thousand, then 50,000, then 400,000. And eventually 50,000 churches just in the United States alone. Even today, even though we're not the largest denomination, we have the most churches in the United States. Because we were so huge at one point, we had to have all these churches to fill everybody, and we're not good about closing churches. In many denominations, if the church gets too small, they close the doors and tell you to move over to the one down the road. We don't do that. Maybe that's a good thing, maybe that's a bad thing. I don't know. I guess if you're one of the members of one of those small churches, it's a good thing. But if you're a member of the other church down the road that would like to have those people, maybe it's a bad thing. I don't know. But we tend to keep our churches open. But the reality is the reason we still have today 36,000 churches is because there was a time when everybody in Methodism wouldn't have fit in 36,000 churches because the faith was genuine and people wanted it. But what happens is over time, things go on a bell curve, right? We get to a point where we start to lose it and we become half Christians. We become the kind of people that Wesley was trying to change. And we become the people before the revival instead of the people after the revival. So what do we learn from that? Now, like I said, eventually we're going to talk about the growth. We're going to talk about what that explosion looked like. We're going to talk about what Methodism looked like when it got started. But today we're going to talk about what it looked like when it was four young men who just wanted to know God. It all began with a passion for the gospel. It's as simple as that. They had a Bible in their hands, and they wanted to know what was in it. They didn't want to know what the Word said. They knew what the Word said. They'd grown up Christians. They'd been in Sunday school. They'd been in church. They knew what the words were. But they wanted to know what it said. They wanted to know what it was supposed to mean for their lives. They wanted to know what it was supposed to mean for their souls. And they wanted to know the God who authored that Bible. That connection was powerful and incredible. And that passion is what caused it to grow. They had a reverent understanding of Holy Communion. It was not an obligation to do once a week or once a month. It was something that you did every time you met because God had given you this incredible opportunity to be in the physical presence of Christ. Given this opportunity to receive communion and given this opportunity for the forgiveness of sins, why wouldn't you want to do that as often as you could? Then understand the communion stayed with Methodism pretty much until the Civil War. That passion for the gospel, the passion for the scriptures, and the passion for communion, that's what brought early Methodism to revival. So for this week, my prayer is that our component of revival that we weave into our lives, that component would be a passion for knowing God. Just a passion for thinking about your own faith and wondering how it could be closer to God. A passion for God is where it all starts. My prayer for us is that we become the church and the people who, when we leave from here, people say, gee, I really want what they've got. I want to know God the way that person knows God. I want to know God the way you know God. And my prayer for us is that we become those kinds of people. This is an incredible faith. We serve an incredible God. And it should really bother us that there are people outside who don't know that God as well as they should. And it should really bother us if we're one of those people who don't know God as well as we should. Amen.